There's a word here I can't read. I don't know who's written this. Sure. No, it's only one I can't read. My eyesight is really poor. It's my eyesight, not your handwriting. This one. How do we? Oh, merit. Okay. Okay. As usual, we are gathered here today to listen to another dispensation of the Lord Buddha's teaching. Before we commence this sermon, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves that it is because of the Supremely Enlightened One, the Infinitely Compassionate One, the Perfectly Enlightened One, the Unvanquished One, the Undefeated One, the Undefeatable One, the Gautama Supreme Buddha, that we have this Dhamma today. It is thanks to him that today we are able to cleanse our minds and find peace within ourselves. It doesn't take anyone long to recognize that they are not the same person they used to be. If you have been listening to this Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, for some time in your life, so it is the Dhamma that has transformed you to who you are now, and it is because of the Buddha that we have this Dhamma today. So before we commence, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the Supreme Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
And as usual, before we commence, let us take a moment to observe the five precepts. Bearing in mind, as I remind you regularly, we must never forget that we are again having to observe these precepts, because the state of our minds is that we are prone to breaking these precepts on various occasions and situations and circumstances in our lives. This is the plight, this is the pity. This is only because of ignorance and attachment that prevails in our minds, which is quite shameful. So, once again, before we listen to this sermon, we are having to observe the five precepts, making a solemn promise to ourselves that from this point forward I shall abstain from unmeritorious deeds, and that is the promise you give to yourself, not anybody else. This is the promise you give to yourself. But reminding ourselves that hopefully this is the last time I have to observe the precepts. May the virtue contained within these precepts be part of the very fabric of who I am, part of the very fabric of my conscience. With that determination, with that resolve, in order to observe the five precepts, I invite you all to chant the Namaskara 3 times once again and all together. Let's try that again, all together.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saraṇāgamanaṃ sampunnaṃ. Pānāti pātā veramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhyāmi. Adinnādāna veramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhyāmi. Kāmesu micchācārā veramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhyāmi. Musāvādā veramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhyāmi. Surāmeraya majjapamā daṭṭhānā veramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhyāmi. Tisaraṇena saddhiṃ pañca sīlaṃ dhammaṃ sādhukaṃ surakkitaṃ katvā appamādena sampādeta.
Okay, we now will be seated. Also, before we commence, let us take a moment to invite all the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons and the dead, our ancestors who have predeceased us, those who have been our mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, grandparents and so on and so forth, relations and neighbors, anyone who might have been of help and support to us in this infinitely long journey in samsara, teachers, in whatever capacity, anyone might have helped you, supported you, assisted you, relieved you of any kind of pain or discomfort at any point in life, not just in this but also in previous lives. It is now our opportunity to repay what it is that they owe, that we owe them. Perhaps our parents in our previous lives may today be born in the woeful plains. That may be the result of them committing unmeritorious deeds on our behalf, for our benefit. Back then they did so to save us from committing unmeritorious deeds, but alas, that did not save them from the consequences of their actions. So today, we have the gift of Dhamma, the gift that excels all gifts. This is the gift that they require, the gift of Dhamma, and the merits that we acquire as we preach, listen to, and discuss the Dhamma. So, and yet you decided to be here. So this is why I thought I should make the most of your time today, and as unconventional as it may be, in the presence of familiar faces, I thought that would be okay. Is this okay? Okay. So this is why I asked Dr. Hamdrud to prepare a whiteboard. And on this, today, and I'm also really glad that we have some young people here, some young children here, familiar faces nevertheless. But I do understand that some of the Dhamma concepts that we talk about can be a little bit deep, a little bit heavy. And we need to do justice to our young listeners who, despite how difficult it may be to understand, it's not so difficult for the adults who come along regularly, but for the young children, I thought we must do them justice. So I'm going to be drawing some pictures to help you understand. How does that sound? Up for that? Good. So I've tried this with our young monks at the monastery, and they have found it quite helpful. And it doesn't matter what age you are, in this square meter or a square 1.5 meters of whiteboard, I shall try to explain to you today that which we have been ignorant of throughout samsara. If you understand, if you comprehend what you're going to be seeing on this board over the next 1.5 hours or so, this is the key that you need to unlock the wheel of samsara. I'm going to be explaining to you from basics, back to our roots, back to the real basic stuff. But it's going to come alive for you today, hopefully. You can ask questions when things are not clear. I will also pause at suitable places and ask you if you have any questions. So make use of that. You must be quite lucky to have come along today. I'm not sure I'm going to do this a second time, but for those of you who are here, then you can make use of this. And perhaps, you know, this is being recorded, we can make this available to our listeners if they choose to watch or perhaps listen to this. And of course, there has to be distractions, right? There has to be. When you try to do something like this, we should be surprised if there are no distractions. I can't remember the last Sunday we did the sermon and it rained. It's been a while. But today, I prepare all this and it has to rain. So try and keep your focus. Try and pay attention, because this is what, the ignorance of what you're going to be seeing on this board is what brought us all in samsara. It's the ignorance of what you're going to be seeing here in the next hour, in the next couple of hours. The reason that you have all had to suffer infinitely in samsara. This is why you grow old. This is why you age. This is why you fall ill. This is why you break a neck. This is why you die and then yet have to keep reborn again and again and again. It's the ignorance of what you're going to be seeing here. So we'll go back to the basics. We'll start from the basics and we'll work our way up. All the way up to covering exactly the fundamental principle of what it is the Buddha came into this world to teach us. Once you've understood this, this is the theory. This is the principle fundamental. If you understood this before you walk out today or today, you can apply this to any problem you have in life. Any problem that brings you mental suffering, you can apply this. Any problem that brings you physical suffering, you can still apply this. If you recognize that the reason you today have a physical body
as a result of which you have to suffer is because you had the mental problem which you did not cure in your previous birth. It's the mind that seeks the body. It's not the body that seeks the mind. Do you understand that? It's the mind that keeps transmigrating. So, to be reborn, the mind has to root itself in a body, has to take place in a body, has to seat itself in a ship, if you like. This is the ship. This is the vehicle. So solve the first problem, the second problem is going to be solved by itself. I've also been handed a bit of paper with a couple of questions, and I think through the course of this, answers will come apparent to you. How do we do merits without having to go through the rebirth process? So that's the first question. Really good questions. Because this shows to me that you're fearful about the rebirth process. You don't like to be reborn. Isn't that a good thing? That's good. You know, the other day, one of our Swaminwanses, he did a sermon in Sinhala, and at the end of that sermon, he had asked a question. It was more of a rhetoric question, not expecting an answer, but he posed the question to the audience, asking the people there, would you all like to become a Sotapanna after having given his sermon? So apparently there was a lady in the audience who put her hand up and said, Swaminwansa, I do like to become a Sotapanna, but I do have a problem with becoming a Sotapanna. Apparently you're only going to be able to be born another 7 times. I don't like that. I want to become a Sotapanna. I just don't like the fact that I can only be born another 7 times. So what you've written here is quite the contrary to that. What you're saying here is, I don't care about Sotapanna, I don't care about Sakurdagami, Anagami, Arahato, whatever you want to call it. I just don't want the rebirth process. How do I put a stop to that? But of course we talk about doing merits all the time. So how does one do merit without going through the rebirth process? So that's the question you have. What a great question. So the second one is a very practical question. I like questions like this, which are very practical. I don't really entertain questions about what do the Brahmavals look like? How do I know? I don't know, go and see for yourself. That's all I can say. How hot it is? Is it in the Sanjeevaka hell? I don't know, you can find out. If you don't understand this, you can find out. But this is a really practical question. So it says, say we eat cake because it gives us pleasure. That's why we eat cake, right? Because it gives us pleasure. I mean, otherwise, why would you have to have cake as dessert? You've just had a meal. You no longer feel hungry. You've just quenched your hunger. You've sated your hunger, but you still go for that piece of cake, knowing fully well that you're full. But you can always make room for that bit of cake, can't you? Like Andare, who had curd. There's always room for curd, for Andare, right? Our non-native speakers will not know what I just said, but let's move on. Say we eat cake because it gives us pleasure, and we continue to eat, but at some point we get sick of it. That's so true, isn't it? At some point you're going to get sick of it. It's like anything. You watch TV, cartoons. How many times can you watch the same episode of the same cartoon? If you could keep watching it time and time again, why do you think producers and directors have to work hard so much? Coming up with new episodes every week, every day? You can just repeat the same episode. And why do you need so many different channels? If it's watching TV that gives you pleasure, then why do you need so many channels? You can just watch the same TV station. Why do you need so many songs? All you need is one song, right? the first song you would have listened to as a baby, whichever song that was, you could have just listened to it all your life. You didn't have to wait for the next album to come out. So it's quite apparent to us, and this is something we experience, that after a while, at some point we get sick of it. And this is not just cake, so this is an example, but it applies to all our senses, whether it's a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, or touch. So we get sick of it and cannot eat it anymore. Is there a process in the mind for this to happen? What a great question again. Why does this happen? Where is it made? Enough now. Let's move on to something else. Who makes that call? Who makes that decision? Is it the tongue? Is it the mouth? Is it the brain? Is it the mind? Questions. So, very practical questions. So we'll cover them as we go through the explanation I'm going to be doing to you, for you now. So I'm going to put this to a side today because I'm going to need my hands free. Do we not have an eraser? Oh, you're so clever, that's Andrew. Thank you. Are we still okay for the camera? Something I was really good at school was what? You'll find out in a bit. Who's this? Yes. This is you. I understand. It looks prettier than you really are, but still, this is you. Okay? What's that? A rotten apple? The world. This is you. This is your world. This is the world that we live in. How do we know that? How do we know that you live in this world? Yes, Buddha? You're going to have to speak up because otherwise I'm going to have to hand you all a microphone. We don't have that many to go around. So you're going to have to speak up if you're going to answer. How do we know that you live in this world? Because we're alive. How do you know you're alive? Breathing. Breathing, right? Breathing. How else? Can you feel your heartbeat? If you put your hand to your chest, you can feel your heartbeat. So you know you're alive. How else do you know you're alive? 5 senses. Now you're going to see the extent of my skill. Can you all see that? You can't see this? Sorry? Oh. You didn't expect to get a demonstration. If you come closer, will you be able to see? You can come closer. You can use a stool over there for that. You can come and sit here. Bring the stool and sit here. If that's close enough, can you see that? Yeah? Okay. Anyone else? Everyone else okay to see? You can see this? Great. Okay. So, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and this is the body. Okay? So I've just drawn a hand here. That's a hand. And that's a tongue, by the way. Nose, ear, and eye. These are your 5 organs. This is the organ through which you see. This is the organ through which you hear. The organ through which you smell, taste, and touch or feel sensations. Now, when I asked you the question, how do you know you're alive? There were 2 responses that came initially. One said, you can breathe. Which of these senses pick up the fact that you're breathing? Nose picks up smell. Can you smell that you're breathing? So how do you know you're breathing then? You can feel you're breathing, can't you? So even if you closed your eyes, you can still feel your lungs expand. Yes, as the air flows in, and then as the air flows out, you can feel this, your lungs expanding. So you can feel it. And your heart beating, you can feel your heart beating as well. These are all physical sensations. So the fact that when you say you know you're alive because your heart's beating and your lungs are expanding as you take air in and push it out, that's something you sense through the sense of touch. But there are, again, another 4 here. You can hear me speak, can't you? Therefore, you know that you're alive. Yes, you do know that I'm alive as well, but you know that you're alive because you can hear what I'm saying. You can see me, therefore you know that you're alive. Hopefully you can't smell me from where you are, but you can smell the atmosphere. You can smell perhaps incense. You can smell flowers. This is how you know you're alive. When you put something in your mouth, a chocolate or whatever, you can taste it. And when you can taste it, now you know you're alive. So these are your 5 organs. This guy, you, have all 5 of these. Now, you also have a pretty neat organ called the brain. Where's the brain? For some people, it's around here. Where their tummy is. Some people. I used to be like that. But then later on I got to listen to the Dhamma and my brain started to shift. thankfully upwards. Eventually, it shifted and eventually it stopped at the top of my skull. So the brain, my brain now is somewhere here. Okay? So the brain is something that looks like this. Something like that. What the brain does is it's a communicating machine. It's like a communication center. It's responsible for communicating all around the body, all those inputs that come in, all these stimuli that come in from the outside world. The brain is responsible for keeping contact, keeping communication between these organs which bring in inputs from the outside world. Let's see for a moment what are the inputs that come from the outside world. What comes in through the eye? Sight. So, let's say, sight. You can see a flower, right? That's a sight. What comes in through the ear? Sound. What's that? Thank you. That's a bee. You can hear a bee. So you know you're alive. What comes in through your nose? Smell. What do you like to smell? Pizza. Flowers, yes, okay. So, to smell a flower, the flower has to come closer. It can't be as far as it is, as it has to be when you want to see it. To smell it, it has to be closer than it is when you want to try and see it, okay? So the flower comes closer. Same flower. That's the fragrance. You can smell the flower. Tongue. What can you... Chocolate. Chocolate good with everyone? Let's go with chocolate then. That's a chocolate. Then, touch. Beg your pardon? Velvet. You're very creative. So touch is the sensation through which you know that there are things around you. You can feel solid. You can feel soft. You can feel temperature, right? Heat and cold, these are things that you can feel through the sense of touch. So velvety, you know, when you feel a fabric and it's slippery, then you know it's velvety. Is that a real word? Did I just make it up? Probably did. Anyway, you know what, through the sense of touch, you can sense physical objects and temperature. Okay? So, I'm going to draw a flower again, because you can touch a flower. So, through these five organs then, you can take inputs from the outside world. Why did I draw a world here? It's because all these things that you see here, they're all part of the world that you live in. So these things, you're going to find in the world that you live in. Okay? What happens if you fly to the moon? Are you going to find anything different? What, there's chocolate on the moon? Flowers on the moon? What about bees? I can't hear you, sorry. We can bring one. You can take one to the moon, yes. So what I want you to understand is, although I've drawn a picture of the world that we live in, what I really mean by this world is really everything that comes in through your senses. So everything you see here, every item, every object, every person, the sun, the moon, the stars, the rivers, trees, birds and bees, bats and bowls and all these things that we see around here, the chairs that you sat on, your water bottles that you brought here with you today, the clothes that you're wearing, all these things are part of the world that we live in. So it's our five organs that help us bring the outside world into the inside world. So now, where's the inside world? That's what we need to find out. Where's the inside world? This is the mind. Now, where's the mind on this fellow? That's where the brain is. So we know that that's where the tummy is. Whereabouts do you think the mind is? Ah. You've been listening to sermons. So we know that there's an organ called the heart. Okay? Which also looks something like this. That looks like a sad face. But trust me, I've tried to draw a heart. So that's a heart, okay? The heart is somewhere here. Just below your... just by the side of your left arm. Okay? On the left-hand side of your body. And the heart is the organ which pumps blood around the body. So for our young listeners here, if you didn't know that. Now, if one asks where the mind is... the mind is not in the heart, although I've drawn a picture of the heart here. An alive person always has blood in the heart. The mind is located associating a quantity of blood that is in the heart. That's the best explanation that I can give. Because that's what's written in the book. Not that I've seen where the mind is. That's what is written in the book. In what book? In the Abhidhamma. Okay? I'm not saying go now start reading the Abhidhamma. Because it really doesn't matter where the mind is. Doesn't matter where the mind is. Here, 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 or here. It really doesn't matter. But this is just a matter of fact. That the mind is associates a quantity of blood in the heart. So what happens if you stand on your head? Now all the blood in the heart is going to drain. No, thankfully you have your bicuspid valves and your tricuspid valves, right? So there's always going to be a small quantity of blood in your heart. Any alive heart is going to have that. So just because you stand on your head doesn't mean your mind's going to flush out. And then you're going to have to go around your body trying to bring your mind back into your heart. So don't worry about that. Really, it really doesn't matter where your mind is. But this is just extra information for those among you who are curious. You're not curious, are you? You know the answer to that. Curiosity did what to the cat? Killed it. So be careful. So, that's where the mind is. Now, you've got the world, you've got your five senses. This brain, the reason I said this is a translator is because its job is to translate messages from the outside world that come in through your five senses into the mind. The mind only speaks one language. And this language only has five words in it. It only has five words. How many words are there in English? About a million, possibly more. Right? So, but the mind only speaks one language and there are only five words in this language. If you've been coming along to sermons and listen to these sermons, you will know what these five words are. What are they now? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyan. Okay. So I'm going to erase you. I'm going to write down Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vinyan. This is the only language, or these are the only five words that the mind speaks. The mind does not know any other language. But where's Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyan in the flower? Is there any Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyan in the flower? No. Is it there in the bee? No. Is it there in the chocolate? No. So this is one language, and this is another language. So you need someone to translate between these two languages. It's like I'm talking to you in English right now. Let's say there was a foreigner, someone who comes from Russia. He only speaks Russian. We're going to have to find a translator who can translate every word I say into Russian so he understands. Otherwise, he's just going to be sitting here like a duck, not knowing what it is I'm saying, right? So for the mind to understand what's going on in the outside world, this fellow, or rather this fellow, is going to have to do some translation. This is a pretty hectic job. It's not easy, this job of a translator, because he has to do it on the fly. What does it mean to do it on the fly? It means you have to do it right now, not tomorrow. So you can't see the flower today and he does the translation tomorrow. It has to happen live, like live TV. You see, when you see live TV, it's happening right now, wherever it is happening in the world. So like that, this translator has to translate the sight that came in through the eye, or the ear, or the nose, or tongue, or body, all these inputs that came in from the outside world, comes into the brain, which is the communication center. And what this guy does is it translates all those inputs, sense stimuli, to this language that the mind speaks. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankar, Vinyan. So, eye sees flower. What does the brain translate flower into? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankar, Vinyan. The tongue tastes chocolate. Input signal goes to the brain. What does the brain translate that into? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankar, Vinyan. So whatever comes from the outside world, what the brain does is translate it into Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankar, Vinyan. So that's what's going on here. Okay. All clear so far? All good? All clear as mud? Okay. So you can ask questions when I ask you, when I pause for questions, please feel free to ask questions. It's not every day you get a bank holiday or a public holiday. You've got to make the most of it. So you've got some young children here today, and I doubt you're going to be here next Sunday. So I'm glad that this is the day we chose to do this. Yes. Sorry? That's what we call? Yes. So this is what I was going to come to. This is the world that we can see. The eye can see, not the mind can see. There's the outside world and there's the inside world. The inside world is created by the mind, or it's created in the mind, within the mind. This inside world is created. I can't show you that world because it's not a physical world. When the brain picks up a sight that comes in through the eye, it's now translated into Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, and that is now a building block of the inside world. But, you know, we can see flower. Remember, it's not just the eye doing its job there. The mind is also working. Yes, there's a flower, so the eye has to pick up light that comes from the outside, and then it leaves an input in the brain, a stimulus on the brain, and the brain now does translation, like I said, on the fly. This is happening live. And the mind picks up Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, and now the mind knows, flower. Okay? So what you're really seeing is the inside world. Because remember, the mind does not understand flower. The mind only understands Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. Sanya, or this ID, is what you've given to that object. Therefore you call it a flower. If you'd call it cake, you'd be saying, hey, look at that cake hanging off the ceiling. This is the label you've given it. So let's understand a little bit about what this Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana is before we move any further. This Rupa is not the same Rupa that the eye sees, but it's a product of it. It's the translation of the outside rupa. that the mind can pick up. So it's a sense stimulus, sense imprint rather, on the mind. It's like taking a photocopy. It's not the original, but it's not very different from the original either. It's like a copy of it. Okay? You can take as many copies of the original as you like. So take a flower. You can take as many copies of the flower as you like. All these copies are being created where? In the mind. But there's only one original. There's only one pen here. But every time I keep looking at it, with every second, there are many billions of copies that are being made inside my mind. A copy is made and it passes away. Another copy and it passes away. Another copy and it passes away. This is what happens continuously. So that copy that is being made in my mind, that's not the original. But it's not very different to the original either. You get the idea? So there are six types of rupa. Rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, pottabha rupa and dhamma rupa. Why six? Well, remember we talked about five organs and then we talked about the mind, right? So rupa is the rupa that comes in through the eye. So when going back to the flower that was in front of the eye, eye picks up light that comes from the outside world. Now the eye, the rods and cones on your retina have been stimulated. Now they send an impulse into your brain. Now the brain translates, because it was an input that came through the eye, the brain now translates that into a rupa. So the mind knows that this came in through what? The nose. Yes? No, through the eye, because it was a rupa. The next moment you hear a bee that's flying to the flower. Shabda rupa. Then someone brings that flower to your nose. Gandha rupa. Hopefully they don't put it on your tongue, so they put a bit of chocolate to you, and then you put on your tongue, now it's rasa rupa. And then you can feel the flower, that's a pottabha rupa, or sparsha rupa. This is, hopefully you can understand what these things mean. So rupa is the sights that you see, but the imprint of that on the mind. Shabda rupa are the sounds that you hear, but not the exact sound, but the imprint of that on the mind. It's like the copy of it. It's like a photocopy. Okay? Make sense so far? And then finally you have the dhamma rupa. These are memories. Things you've done in the past. If I say home, can you see your house right now in front of you? Not physically, but in your mind. You know exactly where the front door is. You know what color the door is. You know what color your key is. You know how big the keyhole is. You know how many times you need to turn it. Right? You know all these things. And you can picture it like you're standing in front of it right now. If I say last night's dinner, all that comes rushing back. Right? So these are all dhammas that came in, that you took previously, which were left as memories in your memory banks, and now you're able to pull them. Understood? Okay. So rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, as I said, so there are six of them. Then there's vedana. There are three types of vedana. Actually, there's four. Vedana is feeling, or rather sensation. It's knowing that something's happened. It's like if you have an alarm system at home, okay? You've set the alarm system and, nowadays you have smart alarm systems which send alerts to your mobile phones and things like that. Let's say your alarm system's been triggered. A burglar or maybe a cat or whatever. You don't know what it is yet, but you just know that it's been triggered. So you know that something's happened, you don't know what's happened yet. So there's a difference between the two. Something's happened, not sure what it is. Quite yet. Are you with me? So something's happened. This is what Vedana picks up. Something going on. Now, when something's going on, this comes in, as I said, four forms. One of these is exclusively experienced only by an arahant. You're never going to experience this until you become an arahant. And that is called upeksha tara upeksha. I don't know the English word for that. I'm not even going to make it up. Maybe I can come up with one next week. Can any one of you have any suggestions? Okay, we'll come up with one next week. It's upeksha tar upeksha. I'm going to call it UTU.
For the time being.
Upeksha tar upeksha, which is equanimity that goes beyond the equanimity that you and I can experience. Because really, although we call upeksha to be equanimity, this upeksha really lies within vexation. It's the feeling of vexation. That is what that upeksha is. So this is the upeksha that anyone apart from an arahant experiences. That sensation is upeksha. Then you have sapadukha, or good and bad. These are all sensations that we experience, but they are fabrications of our own mind. So we have pleasant and unpleasant. Pleasant feeling or sensation, unpleasant sensation, equanimous or upeksha sensation, and then upeksha tara upeksha, which is equanimity that really goes beyond the equanimity which is experienced by mundane or non-arahants. Okay? So these three non-arahants, and this only by an arahant. With me so far? Okay. Then you have sanya. Sanya is perception. This is the label that you give to anything. You call this a flower because that's the label you've given to this object. Because when you ask your mother, "Mother, what is that?" She said flower. So then you gave that rupa a label, flower. So this is a label. Quite simply, that's what it is. A label. Then you have sankhara. These are formations. The job of sankhara is to pull all these together. That's one task of sankhara. So the English word for this is formation. It's to execute this. Making this happen. In other words, identifying that it was a rupa, rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, pottapa rupa, dhamma rupa, that has to be identified. Okay? Then you have to come up with one type of sensation. Then you have to give it a label. Not necessarily in that particular order, but all these things have to happen in one go, essentially. All that activity is run by this. This is the tool. This is the guy that does the job. Okay? Formation, and there's also another task that meaning behind sankhara, and that is the doing word or the doing noun, the verb noun, if you like. For example, I say pen. What word comes to mind? Write. That's the sankhara. Writing is a verb. It's not a noun. But when I say pen, when you see this rupa, writing is the sankhara that is associated with that rupa. Does that make sense? Let's say broom. What comes to mind? Sweep. What about water? That's one. What else? Wash, cook, right? So these are all sankhara that are associated with particular types of rupa. And that could be rupa, rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, pottabha rupa, and so on. So that's one aspect of it. Doing all this is another aspect of it. Okay? And then finally you have vijnana. Vijnana is the final decision that comes out. This is the final decision. So what vijnana does is it wraps all this up. So for instance, when I draw this, the reason that you know that this is a flower which can be smelt, which can be touched, which can be seen, is because all this has happened and there's a wrapper around it. You have made a decision that this is a flower, it can be smelt, it's probably a lovely smell. All that is thanks to vijnana. This is the wrapper that goes around all of this. With me so far? Okay. So that's Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana. I could talk to you about Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana till the cows come home. But all we need to understand is
this is enough. Let's keep it simple. Right? We really don't need to go that far. You don't even need to know this. You don't need to understand what Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana is to attain Nibbana. Seriously. That's how easy attaining Nibbana is. But again, you're curious, aren't you? Then you're going to go home with unanswered questions, and because of that vexation, you're not going to be able to do anything else. You're going to be picking your hairs out. What is Rupa? That's not what you need to worry about, but that's what you will be worrying about. And this is why I thought I'll explain it to you in any case. Right, so let's get that out of here as well. Are you comfortable? You can use that cushion if you like. Okay. Next time, bring a pair of binoculars. Or your specs. Yes. No, they're different. Yes. So, Nama Rupa includes Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana, the lot. If I answer that question, we're going to lose a lot of people. We'll cover that in another day, okay? I'm worried about going into detail, but if I do, then a lot of people will switch off. All right. But Nama Rupa includes the lot, okay? Yes. So now this is the thing. You can look at Sankara in two different ways. One is the Sankara that is required to give birth to a Chitta. Avidya Paccaya Sankara. This is the process of a Chitta coming alive. This Sankara is a constituent part of a Chitta. So Sankara is twofold or threefold. Depends on how you look at it, because the same word is used in lots of different contexts. Depending on the context, it's a different idea. So, absolutely. So this sankara. So as you know, madam, sankara. One classification of it is punyabhisankara, apunyabhisankara, and aninjabhisankara. Right. All these three types of sankara are done by non-arahants, because they're all karmas, right? But even in the Buddha's mind. Every chitta that arises, even in the Buddha's mind, has sankara. This sankara that I just talked to you about. Because the job or the duty of this sankara is, like I said, bringing, you know, it's the activity that happens behind. It's like the cogs, the wheels turning to make all of that happen. So that sankara is universal. In every chitta you find that sankara. But the other sankara you speak of is what happens in the Paticca-samuppada process, the dependent origination process, which whose job it is to bring the chitta alive. Or in other words, bring suffering. As we'll see in a moment. Okay? Right. So far, we are now all sure that we're alive. Any doubts? No. We know that we're alive because we have an eye, ear, nose, tongue and body which bring in sense inputs from the outside world. We all have a good pal called the brain who does that job of translation, right? And when the brain translates whatever comes in through the eye, it leaves an imprint on the mind, and therefore the mind now knows that I've just seen something. Okay? And when you say I have seen something, three things have happened. These are the three things. There's the outside world. So I'm going to call this outside world. There's the eye. And in the mind, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana has arisen and passed away. This is one cycle. One oscillation. Arise and pass away. When that has happened, these three things happen at the same... Once one of these processes, one of these cycles have been executed, we are now able to say, I have seen something. Take away the flower. Have you seen anything? Take away the eye. Have you seen anything? Take away the mind. Have you seen anything? Take away sanya. Have you seen anything? No. Put back sanya. Take away rupa. Have you seen anything?
No.
Put back rupa. Take away vinyana. Have you seen anything? No. These five have to arise together and they pass away together. You're never going to find a chitta in which you're going to only find one of the five, or two of the five, or three or four of the five. If a chitta is going to arise, it's always going to be the five together. If not, none of them are going to come along. It's five or nothing. Okay? So this is what the process of seeing is. This is the process of seeing. Remember last week we talked about a bouncer? There's a process that runs in the mind. Seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, feeling, thinking. These are all processes. So very similar to the seeing process, if you put a sound in front of the ear and then in the mind, thanks to the brain, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana will arise and pass away. That's one cycle. Arising is not sufficient. It has to pass away. When all of that has happened, that's one cycle you've seen. You can say, I have now heard something. In fact, because of vinyana, you can say, I have heard a bee or whatever. Okay? So, this is what's going on. Now, here's the thing. Let's take a closer look at the mind, because this is the really nasty fellow. This is the fellow we are trying to tame, the mind, right? There's no point trying to tame the body, because the mind is the master of the body. And if we have time, I'll speak to you about that later towards the end of the sermon. How the mind is the master of the body, but for some people, they think it's the other way around. They use the mind to please the body. We'll come to that, okay? Let's take a closer look at the mind. Let's zoom in. Here's what happens.
There's a flower. The eye has just been, the eye is open and a flower has just been put in front of it. The brain just picks up. The brain has just picked up this input. And the brain has passed over what? What has the brain just passed over?
A pack of five. It's a pack of five, right? Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana. It's easy to say a pack of five. When this has happened, if I draw the mind, it's going to be something like this. Now, the mind does not have... I can't say this is what the mind looks like. This is only a model of the mind. Okay? Mind does not have a picture, or you can't take a photo of the mind. This is just a model of the mind. Okay? This is what happens in the mind. Each of these is one oscillation, one cycle. A chitta has arisen and is passed away. Another one has arisen, passed away. How many chittas can you see here? Four. How many of these in a second? Many, many millions. So, our task now is to try and work out how many chittas in a second. Yes? No, that's pointless. That's not what we are here to do. We're just trying to understand how is it that the mind works. Because that's what the Buddha came into this world to teach us. This is how the mind works and this is how the mind ends up suffering. So all this is to that end, ladies and gentlemen, for nothing else. This is not just for your interest. This is not a bedtime story, by the way, either. The reason I'm going through this explanation is to show you how, because of what's going on here, you end up suffering. That's what we are trying to treat here. And then, therefore, what is the cause of suffering, how to seize it, and what is the path. That's what we are going to get to. This is what happens when the eye is now seeing a flower. Five. This five is what happens here.
So with the chitta, you have rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. Arise, and the same is going to pass away.
Rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana.
Okay? I've just split it in two. So this half is the arising half, and this half is the passing away half. Arising and decaying, if you like. In the arising half, you have rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana has just arisen. And at this, just past this moment, it's going to start fading away, passing away, decaying, death, whatever. Okay? That's what's happening here. What about the next one? Same. And the next one? And the following one? It's the same. It's the same process. So, five has arisen, and five, a pack of five passes away. A pack of five arises, a pack of five passes away. This is what happens in your mind every moment. When did it start? Whenever you started your journey in samsara. So this is what happens in the mind of a human being. What about... That's how I learned to draw rabbits. Rutter. What happens in the mind of a rabbit? So in a human being, we know rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. Pack of five arises, pack of five passes away. What happens in the mind of a rabbit? Same. And a cow? Same. Same. Dog? Pig? Same. What about a deva? Brahma? Same. What about beings in the four great hells? Pretas? Same. Asuras? Same. No matter where you are, if you are alive, if you have a mind, this is what's happening inside. Rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana arises, rupa vedana sanya sankara vijnana passes away. At the same rate. It's not, the speed is no different whether you're a deva, brahma, human, animal, it's no different. It's the same for all of us. If it is 10 to the power a second for a human, it's the same for a rabbit, it's the same for a deva, it's the same for whatever. Whatever beast, all the same. It's the same speed. Okay? Clear so far? Alright. Now, here's a problem. There's a problem with this. What I've just drawn here is the nature of an arahant. An arahant who does not have what? Two things. Attachment and ignorance. No attachment because no ignorance, or no ignorance because no attachment? Which way? Why is there no attachment in an arahant? Because there is no ignorance. It's ignorance that leads to attachment. You can't eradicate attachment and leave ignorance behind. You have to work on ignorance. When you work on ignorance, attachment will be eradicated. That's how it happens, right? This is why we preach the Dhamma. I'm not preaching the Dhamma. You don't listen to the Dhamma to eradicate attachment. It's to remove ignorance. When you have gained wisdom, then ignorance is removed. Along with ignorance, attachment goes away. Okay? So this is the nature of the mind of an arahant. Now let's look at the nature of us. Ourselves. And rabbits and all these other beings. This is running on a platform. For us. And this platform is called... In Sinhala it's called Chandaraga or Pali. In English, it's called ignorance and attachment. Chanda is ignorance, raga is attachment. Chandaraga. Okay? Ignorance and attachment. So this process is running on a platform of ignorance and attachment on all beings who are not arahants. Now, ignorance is ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Ignorance is ignorance which tells us that this world is pleasurable. Right? This is what ignorance is. There are two types of ignorance, by the way. One ignorance is not knowing how a flower has been formed, not knowing how the eye has been formed, not knowing how the brain is formed. This is what a lot of scientists try and work on. What is the composition of a flower? What is the composition of the eye? What is the composition of the brain? What's the composition of the mind? A lot of scientists try to work on this. But the greatest scientist comes along and says, to hell with that. That's not what you need to worry about. Leave that ignorance out, because that's not something you're ever going to figure out. Become a Buddha one day, then you'll figure that out. So leave that out. Just work on what is within your remit. Our remit is a different kind of ignorance. And that ignorance is, our ignorance tells us that a flower is beautiful. Beautiful flower. Let me write that down. Beautiful flower. There's a composition to flower, as in how a flower has been made up, right? There's also a composition to beautiful. Where did beautiful come from? How is beautiful made up? Which of these two is the ignorance that we are trying to treat? Beautiful. The other type of ignorance is flower. To figure out or to come out of that ignorance, all you have to do is become a supreme Buddha. Simple. If you become a supreme Buddha, you can treat both of these in one go. Buy one, get one free. In fact, what really happens is, you treat this, you get this for free as a supreme Buddha. But if all you're trying to do is, as the lady asked, how do I stop this rebirth process? I don't care whether it's by becoming a Buddha or a Pacheka Buddha, an Arahat, I just want to stop this rebirth process. That's it. Then all you need to do is treat this. You can treat this by becoming an Arahant. But even an Arahant is still ignorant of the composition of a flower. Unless he goes and asks the Buddha, what is the composition? And then he may or may not share that, because he might probably say, what's the point? No, actually, an Arahant will go, what is the point of me even asking? Because although you're curious, an Arahant is not curious. Okay? The reason you're curious is because you haven't treated this problem yet. Because you're still thinking, this world is pleasurable. The reason you say something is beautiful, beautiful is another word for what? Pleasure. It's a kind of pleasure. Delightful is a kind of pleasure. Yummy. What's that? Kind of pleasure. It's a way you express pleasure, is it not? Yummy cake. What does that mean? This cake is pleasurable. Beautiful music. What does that mean? The music is pleasurable. Yes? So, there are two types of ignorance. One is not knowing the composition of a flower. The other is not knowing the composition of beautiful. The ignorance that we are trying to treat is not knowing the composition of beautiful. In other words, why is it that we see the flower as being beautiful? That is what we are trying to treat. Why do we try to fix that problem? Why are we not trying to address this problem? Well, to fix this problem, you have to become a supreme Buddha. In other words, to come out of this ignorance, you have to become a supreme Buddha. And I don't know about you, but I just don't have the patience for that. Second point, the more important point is, it's the ignorance of this that keeps us going round in samsara. Not this. If there were a state where you could pick which ignorance you wanted to address, which one would you prefer? This or this? I'd say go for this. Because even if you were to find the composition of a flower, if you still say that's beautiful, you're still going to go around in samsara. But figure out the composition of why you call something beautiful, then you will realize that this is just fake beauty, and at that point you will no longer find this flower
beautiful. At that point, you will no longer attach yourself to the flower. At that point, stop attachment, stop rebirth. No more suffering. So, this is the process that runs within your mind. Now, here's the problem. The eye has just seen a flower. The mind has, the brain has just translated that sight into a pack of five. This is the pack of five that has just arisen. Remember, there's attachment throughout this cycle. It's non-stop. For as long as there's ignorance, there's attachment throughout this process. There's not a point anywhere in this process where there is no attachment. So, you've got attachment here. What about here? Of course. What about here? And here? And here? Throughout. Here, 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 here. Wherever you look at it, there's always ignorance and attachment. So here's where the problem is. Who here likes to lose something that you're attached to? Do you like to lose something that you're attached to? Do you like the death of something or someone you're attached to? Do you like the loss of something or someone you're attached to? No, if you're not attached to it, then makes no difference. But for as long as you're attached to it, then if you lose something, if it dies, if it decays, then there's a problem. So, are you beginning to see the problem here? A pack of five has arisen, but what happens immediately afterwards? It's going to pass away. Now it's passing away, but nothing's happened to ignorance and attachment. It's still there. You're still attached. You're attached to it throughout this process. At this point you're attached all the way through. But attachment remains. That pack of five which arose, that's passed away. Now you're going, where's my five? Let me put this into a real life situation so you can understand. I think I talked to you about this last week, if you remember. I can't see the time from here. If one of you wouldn't mind just turning that clock. Thank you. I'm going to draw the model of the mind again. Right. Let's take this. A mother goes to the shopping mall with her child. She leaves home with her child, holding the child's hand in hers, and now she's walking in the shopping mall. But it's a busy day, so she's looking around, she's window shopping, and at one moment, the child pulls his hand from the mother's, but because the mother's too busy observing what's going on outside, she does not react to this. She does not, it does not hit her that, you know, she does not realize that the child has just let go of her hand. Okay? So now, she's still walking in the mall, and then at one point she realizes, hang on, where's my child? Now she turns her head to look at the child, but there's no child. As a mother, you will have been in this situation many a time. As a child, you may have also been in this situation where you've gone somewhere with your mother. It could have been the carnival, it could have been to the supermarket, could have been wherever. You're holding on to your mother's hand for safety and comfort, and somehow or the other, your mother is too busy, she lets go of your hand, and now you can't find your mother. Have you all not experienced this in some way, shape or form? Whether it's your mother and child, or husband and wife, or whatever, right? Friends, we've all experienced this at some point in our lives, in whatever situation. This is just an example. Now, if that situation, in that situation, imagine this child that the mother's now looking for appears. So he comes running from somewhere and says, Ami, I'm here, I'm here. How does the mother feel at that point? A sigh of
relief. Ah, thank goodness. Now she looks again at the windows, doing her shopping. And she looks back to where the child was, and he's gone again. How does the mother feel again? Pretty tensed, pretty nervous, right? Worried, vexed, right? This is vexation all over. Now again she's looking, where's my child? Where's my child? Where's he gone? Where's he gone? And again the child comes, Ami, I'm here, don't worry, don't worry. How's the mother going to feel again? Relief. Thank goodness. Don't do that again, the mother says. And she turns away in the hope that this child is not going to do that again. But sure as hell, she turns her head again, and what's happened to the child again? He's gone again. He's gone AWOL. Now again, what happens to the mother? Again she's tensed, again she's worried, again she's vexing. Where's my child? And again he comes running from afar. Ami, I'm here, don't worry. Again a sigh of relief. Now imagine, right, we've all experienced this at some point in our life. Imagine this happening at 10 times a minute. This is like the mother going through life and death 10 times a minute, is it not? Because for a mother to lose her child, or for the child to lose his or her mother at such a young age, is like, that's like death, or similar to death. It's that feeling of fear, worry, vexation, right? It's a very uncomfortable feeling. It's like a feeling between life and death for this mother. At 10 times a minute, this is happening. Because at 10 times a minute, the child's appearing and disappearing. Appearing and disappearing. Appearing and disappearing. Now you can all understand? Can you all sense what I'm trying to explain to you? Now imagine that happening at 100 times a minute. This child appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing at 100 times a minute. Now imagine that at 1 billion times a minute. This mother is going through hell, like life and death, experiencing life and death, not literally, but you know, you understand the feeling behind this, pleasurable feeling and a feeling of intense pressure, intense nervousness, intense anxiety, intense pain at 1 billion times a minute. Can you all imagine that? Right? Now let's come here. In this situation, nothing's happening to the child. But how does the mother know that the child's that she's holding the child's hand? Let's go back to our three things that has to happen. There has to be child. Yes. Then there has to be mother. Yes. So this is object. This is body, and the mother's brain, which leaves an imprint on the mother's mind. How? That's how this is how it works, right? So these three things have to happen. The child has to be there, that's the object. The body has to be there, which picks up sensations from the outside world. And then you have to have the mind. Of course, there's the brain that does the translation. So these three things primarily have to happen. Yes? All with me so far? Now imagine this. This was happening, we said, initially at 10 times a minute. So at 10 times a minute, the brain is picking up signals from the outside because the mother's holding onto the child's hand, and a pack of five is arising and passing away at 10 times a minute. But what we know now is that this happens at many billion times a second. The mother's holding on to the child's hand, but still, the only way that the mother's mind knows that the child is there with her is when five has arisen. It's at this point that the mother knows that the child is holding on to her hand. But what happens to whatever arises? Passes away. Now, that five that arose here is now passing away. At this point, indeed, she's still physically, she's holding on to the child's hand. But this five that was translated by the outside world, by the brain, using an input from the outside world, has just passed away. Now, the mother is going, where's my child? Physically, she's holding on to the child's hand. But in the mind, she's going, where's my child? But we know there's a platform on which this process is running. Ignorance
and attachment. Is there attachment at this point? Yes or no? Yes. Attachment at this point? At this point? At this point. Well, great. The mother has child with her. What about this point? Is there attachment? There's attachment. But is there child? No child.
Now, the mother's attached to the child, but there's no child. How does the mother feel at that point? Intense vexation. This is what's happening. In the mother's mind, this is what's happening. At this point. That's a question mark. What's the question mark? Where's my child? But physically she's holding on to the child's hand. She's holding on to the child's hand, but the mind is now not able to pick up that. Because the mind only speaks one language and there are only five words in that language. Those five words arose at this point, but now they passed away. Now she's going, where's my child? And again, body, object is present. What the brain does is another input comes in. Another five just arose. My still attachment is still there. Nothing's happened to the attachment. And at this point, the missing child has returned. What happens when the missing child returns? Intense pleasure this time. But intense pleasure always came before what? After what rather? Intense vexation. Where's my child? Thank God there's my child. Where's my child? Thank goodness there's my child. Where's my child? Imagine that happening at a billion times a second. Yes. So you see, madam, for there to be pleasure, there has to be pain beforehand. Because it's not whether the child is arising or passing away that matters in this situation. This is why I'm saying, ignorance is twofold. The composition of child and the composition of my. Which of these leads to suffering? Ignorance of this. Because this is what this is. Ignorance and attachment. In an arahant's mind, there is no attachment. There is no ignorance. Therefore, there is no my. There's only child. When there's only child, it doesn't matter whether I'm holding on to his hand or not. Why? No attachment. So it doesn't matter whether the child is there. It doesn't matter whether the child is not there. Who cares? Because it's not my child. I'm not attached to the child. Then, doesn't matter. Now that's happening at a billion times a second. For all sentient beings. Do you see why arising and passing away is the reason that this world is vexatious? How can you live with attachment in a world or in by when you possess a mind, when you have a mind that arises and passes away in this way, how can you even begin to think about being happy with attachment? Because attachment is there throughout. You know, if this were the case, no attachment here. Now that'd be great. Because the moment you, or let's say it like that. There's only attachment when the child is with you. Oh, that's alright then. Again, at this point, there's attachment, but at this point, no attachment. So, non-arahant, arahant. Have you any being you've heard of like that? You're either an arahant or you're not an arahant. For as long as you are not an arahant,
this attachment runs all the way through. Can you change the nature of the mind arising and passing away? What about the Buddha? Can the Buddha change it? No. There is no one that can stop this arising, passing away unless you enter Nirodha Samapatti, which is the furthest you can get in terms of Samadhi through meditation, through deep meditation, but you have to be an Arahant to get there even still. Or you have to enter Parinibbana, which is the cessation of all life, full stop, body and mind. At that point, the mind does not arise again. These are the only two states in which you can stop this from happening. In every other state, including the state you're in right now, you're hearing my voice at a rate of a billion times a second, and you lose your capability to listen at a billion times a second. So if you're attached to the voice that you're hearing right now, at a billion times a second, guess what? You're going deaf. You're at a billion times a second, you're blind. You're going blind. Yeah. At a billion times a second, you can't sense anything in this world. It's like you're in a dark room. And you can't even sense the flow that you're in. You're on. Now how are you going to feel? You're so attached to sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch. But none of these things are coming to you. Or it's like a coma. You can't sense anything going on in the outside world, but that doesn't mean you're not attached to them. Attachment, it does not arise and pass away along with the mind. Attachment is constant. What arises and passes away is the mind that runs on this platform of attachment. But imagine this happening to this mother. How sorry do you feel for this mother? Again, at this point, the mother is with child. Again, at this point, the mother is going what? Where's my child? But physically, she's holding on to her hand. Or onto the child's hand. Now tell me, is the cause of suffering not having a child? Because a lot of people say, I don't have a child, therefore I'm sad, I'm suffering. Well, what about people who do have a child? Are they also not going through this? Mother's holding a baby in her arms. She's standing next to a mother who just lost her child at pregnancy. Or she was about to be a mother, but she's not a mother now. They're both having a conversation. One's going, oh, you have a child. You're so blessed. You're so lucky. I don't have a child. Therefore, I'm suffering. I'm so sad. True or false? Absolute false. Completely false. They are both suffering. They're both suffering. Because even if you have a child in your arms, you can only feel that there's a child in your arms when this five has arisen. At the point the five passes away, this pack of five passes away, physically there's a child on your hands, in your arms, but you can't feel it. You don't know it. Your mind does not understand that. So the mind's going, where's my child? Do you see why? This is the reason. Udavima vayavima, udayavya. Arising and passing away. This is what anicca is. You can't stop this from happening. This is why this world is vexatious. Not vexing, but vexatious. In other words, prone to vexation if this exists. Do you understand that? Because of this nature of the mind, this world is vexatious. In other words, it's prone to leaving the mind vexing, but the mind has to have an attribute. Ignorance and attachment. Remove this. Now, does it matter whether it's arisen or passed away? Passed away and not arising again. Problem? Arising but not going to be passed away. Problem? No. So arising and passing away is not the cause of suffering. If it were the case, then the Buddha would have said, monks,
I proclaim that the cause of suffering is what? Arising and passing away. Is that what he said? No, he said what? Attachment is the cause for suffering. In other words, it's the platform on which this process is running. That is the cause for suffering. Because you can't change this. This is a fixed nature. Remember, a while ago I talked to you about an equation that expresses suffering. The equation for suffering. Let me remind you. Have you all done simple equations? Have you done, Buddha? You? Okay. Most of you have. This X times Y equals Z. X is anicca world. Z is suffering. What's Y? Attachment. This Z can take two values. Either 1 or 0. Which would you like it to be? That's an easy question, isn't it? Which is it now? 1. So we don't like this. So let's get rid of that. That's not what we want. That is what it is now. Yes? So we want to turn this into a 0. So it's 1 now. We want it to turn into a 0. Now, this equation has 2 terms. Well, this is what it is now. Yes? The world is anicca, and you're attached to it, and now you're suffering. We want to turn this to a 0. How many ways are there? How can you get a 0 on the right hand side? Yes, Buddha? Yeah. Yes? Is there any other way you could do this? No. So this is what it is now. One of this is our target. Yes? Okay. One of this is our target, this is where we are now. So the 3 different ways of eradicating suffering is either you have to keep an anicca world and get rid of suffering or get rid of attachment, then there's no longer suffering. Or you can keep your suffering, change the fact that the world is anicca, turn it into a nitya world and still there's no suffering. Or you can work on both of them and then you can make it 0. Now, which one of these do you think is feasible? What about this one? Keep attachment and change the world to be nitya. In other words, stop arising and passing away. Why did the 5 arise? Is it because you wanted it to? Why did it pass away? Is it because you wanted it to? Then why? Okay, causes. For as long as there are causes, they will arise. For as long as there are causes, they will prevail. And when the causes cease to exist, then the result will decay, will pass away, right? So this is what cause and effect. This is what cause and effect is. That is the nature of an anicca world. It arises and passes away because of the causes that determine or that underlie this result, this nature of it. Okay? So therefore, the only feasible thing to do, the only practical thing to do is really work on attachment. That is, change attachment to a zero, and then there is no suffering. Because it doesn't matter, if this is a zero, it really doesn't matter what value this is. It could be anicca 10 times over. What if
it was a 10?
It's 10 times anicca. It's still zero. Why? No attachment. What if it was 100 times? Still zero. Why? No attachment. This doctrine is only ever proclaimed by the Buddha. Every other religious leader, every other philosopher, there ever was, there ever is, and there ever will be, will talk to you about this. They'll say, don't worry about attachment. Keep your attachment. They'll say, love thy neighbor. Love your neighbor. Just make sure you've got good neighbors. Yes or no? Keep your attachment. Keep your affections. Keep your lovings. Keep your connections. Just go and change the world to your liking and then everything will be fine. Except for the Buddha. The Buddha says, no. Because, indeed, madam, when you have this, this is the outside world. Who are you trying to fix now? You're trying to fix the outside world. But if you do this, attachment happens where? In the outside world? Where does attachment happen? Is it in the flower? Is it in the eye? Or is it in the mind? It's in the mind. Attachment arises here. Fix attachment. Eradicate attachment. Now, does it matter whether there's a flower or not? Does it matter? There is a flower. Is that a problem? There's no flower. Is that a problem? There's an eye. Is that a problem? There's no eye. Is that a problem? You go blind. Is that a problem? No. Why? No attachment. But for as long as there is attachment, for as long as this is a one, I'm not saying eradicate the mind, okay? Eradicate attachment in the mind. Once that has happened, now, or when there's attachment in the mind, now, you like flowers, and you also like the eye. There is a flower. Great. There's no flower. Problem. You have an eye. Great. You go blind. Problem. But fix this. Now, doesn't matter. Fix this. One day, the mind doesn't arise. Problem? No. But for as long as you try to fix either of these two things, and attachment is still there in your mind, this is always going to be a one. Do you recognize the problem? Yes. Okay. You're going to have to excuse me for a few minutes. I'm taking medication, so you'll have to excuse me for a few minutes. I'll be back. Think about the question you just asked me. I'll be back in a moment. Is that okay? Okay. So there was a question before that. I'll come back to it in a moment. So the question that the lady asked was, when you meditate, you experience... Sure. So, meditation can be done in two ways. One is mundane and the other is supramundane. Laukika and Lokottara. Okay? When you are doing... Because supramundane meditation is nothing other than contemplating on anicca dukkha anatta, which is contemplation on the fact that there is nothing pleasurable in the outside world. The sights are not pleasurable because there is no pleasure to be found in them. It's contemplating on the fact that it's attachment that leads to suffering. So when that is your contemplation, then clearly attachment is suppressed at least. If not removed, at least suppressed. So if attachment is what leads to vexation, frustration, mental agitation and all that, at that phase, or while you're in meditation, if attachment is suppressed, then clearly you're going to experience that, at that, during that period of time, you're going to feel relief from suffering to some extent. The other kind of meditation is where you fix your mind on a particular object. You focus your mind on one thing. It could be something solid, something watery, something like maybe fire. It doesn't matter what the mental object is. It could be a flower. It could be a rock. It could be anything. You just focus your mind on one thing. But that has nothing to do with attachment. Attachment is still there, but you're focusing your mind on one thing. So what happens then is constantly... The mind is being refreshed. Every time a pack of five passes away, the next moment you're feeding another pack of five of the same thing. Because at that point in time, while you're in that state of meditation where you have a, there's an attachment to that mental object you have taken. Let's take an example. Let's take the flower, okay? You can go into a deep trance by just focusing on a flower. You look at the sight of the flower, and then you focus your mind on that. Now, while you're in that state of meditation, you can even go into jhanas. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and so on. In that state of jhana, what happens is, in your mind, nothing else, there is no room for anything else to arise. It's only the five that are to do, that pack of five to do with the flower, the sight of the flower, that's all that arises and passes away. Again, arises and passes away, arises and passes away. Now, because that's what's happening, you're not getting inputs from anything else from the outside world. All you're focusing is on this sight. So no sounds coming in, no tastes. And if you go into something like the fourth jhana, jhana samapatti, then you can't even sense your body. Everything else stops. Even your heartbeat stops at that point. So if a doctor were to examine you, they'd say that you were a dead man. But you have fixed your attention on one object. And when you fixed your attention on one object, through any one of your senses, typically at that point it will be your mind. Memories from the mind, because so it will be, if it's a flower, it's a flower. If it was some kind of experience you had, it was the experience you had. Right? Let's not go as far as the fourth jhana. Let's say the second jhana. You're looking at a flower and this is your mental object. Now your focus of the object of your attention, and now constantly your mind is being fed with packs of five to do with the sight of the flower. So the moment it passes away, well, you're sure and short guaranteed that there's another five coming your way. So whatever is being consumed, it's being fed continuously. And this is why, at that point, because you are focused, you're attached to one thing, that does not mean there are other attachment to other things have disappeared. They have been suppressed. Attachment to other things have been suppressed. Attachment to the sight of the flower has surfaced. And because the attachment to other things have been suppressed during that time, you feel that relief from vexation. It's only suppressed, not eradicated. But the attachment to the sight of the flower at that point in time has surfaced. And because of that attachment, there's vexation about this particular object. But that is being fed continuously. Every chitta is being fed with that five and nothing else. Now, does that help in some way to answer that question, madam? You sure? Okay. Now, along with the answer to that question, I'd like to go to the question that was asked before about the piece of cake. So we eat cake because it gives us pleasure. But after you eat it for a while, you continue that process, then after a while you become sick of it. So what's going on here then? The things that we give value to are the things that we can't generally get hold of. For example, diamonds. They're valuable. The reason that diamonds are so valuable compared to, let's say, another metal. I mean, let's take gold, for instance. Diamonds are more valuable than gold, right? Last time I checked, that was the case. Has that changed? I don't know. Diamonds are more valuable, right? Okay, so still, the world's how I left it. So diamonds are still more valuable than gold. And that's because diamonds are rarer than gold. For diamonds to have become valuable, let's put more than gold to a side for a moment. For diamonds to have become valuable, there has to have been a view, a drushti, that came from somebody else. Because when all of us came out of our mother's womb, we never came asking for a diamond. We didn't know what diamonds were, let alone how valuable they are. Right? So someone put into our minds, either through adverts or speaking to friends or seeing someone wearing a diamond and asking, what is that? Oh, this is a precious diamond. So the word precious, what is that? Another word for pleasure. Again, someone planted this seed of this wrong view, this distorted view about diamonds. Diamonds are just, that's just another object. Which one's more valuable to an arahant? Diamonds or gold? Which one's more valuable? They're not valuable at all. None of them. None is the answer. Neither. Neither's valuable to an arahant. Because they're both vexatious. And nothing else. If you attach yourself to it, all you're going to be left with is with vexation. Now, the fact that diamonds might last 1,000 years does not matter, because what happens in the mind arises and passes away, arises and passes away, arises and passes away. Okay? So, I'll come back to that later. Now, the reason that diamonds are more valuable then is because it's rarer than gold. So, what that means is, to get this pack of five from diamonds is more difficult than to get a pack of five from gold. Does that make sense? A site, maybe. You can just go online and Google diamonds. You can keep Googling diamonds as many times as you can keep Googling gold. So the sight of a diamond, possibly. But what are these precious metals, what are these rocks for? Is it just to keep looking at? Are you happy with that? Or do you want to take possession of it? You want to take possession of it. It has to be in your hands, or at least somewhere accessible. So you can go and touch it whenever you want to. Right? So you want to bring it that far before you are relieved from vexation. A diamond that you can only just look at, well, you can find them in jewelry stores. That's no good. So why do you then go and pay money for it? Because you want to make it yours, you want to take it home so you can touch it. You can feel it. You can make sure that it's now part of my possessions. Right? So to relieve yourself to that point is more difficult with diamonds than it is with gold. Yes or no? Why? Because diamonds are rarer. Therefore, if this view that diamonds are valuable and gold is valuable in equal amounts have been put into your mind, the fact that one's rarer than the other means you'll be vexing for one more than the other. Let's say someone comes and says, diamonds are valuable. Gold is equally valuable, someone says. Now you go looking for them. You go looking for them, but you soon realize that actually I can get access to gold easily, but it's not so easy to get hold of diamonds. Now what's going to happen now? The value that you give for diamonds is going to increase. Why? Because in order to relieve yourself from vexation, you have to get hold of a diamond. And to do that is much more difficult than to get hold of gold. So therefore, Your vexation for diamonds can not easily be relieved. You cannot easily be relieved of your vexation for diamonds. You can relatively be easily relieved for your vexation for gold. For silver, it's going to be much easier. And, you know, just think about how did, you know, if a guy is trying to go out with a girl, when does that girl become more valuable? It's when he keeps asking and she says, no. So this is good advice for you guys. And they keep asking, keep saying no. In your mind, you want to say yes, but just don't go for it straight away. Because the more you keep saying no, the more they're going to start vexing and the more value they're going to give you. So on day one, you say, I like you. You say, no, you're not my type. They go, please, gold. You say, no. Next day, they're going to come and ask you again, I love you. Please, can you be mine? No. Please, diamond. Why? Because the value that you give you, they give you, is going to rise. Why? Because now it's becoming more and more difficult to relieve of the vexation that they have because of the attachment that they have to you. But an arahant, are they ever going to come and ask you out? No. An anagami? No. So, the reason that a piece of cake you become sick of, or rather you lose interest in a piece of cake the more you continue to eat it, is because it becomes easily accessible. The first bit of cake, that was new. That was a new experience. You were, let's say, watching TV, someone brings a cake home and says, hey, would you like some cake? Oh, yes, please. The moment they say cake, your mind starts running to the past, brings back old memories. Cake, oh, I like cake. Of course I like cake. Pleasurable. Cake is pleasurable, right? So now immediately all the experience, all those pleasant, pleasurable experiences of the past, of having eaten cake, come rushing to the present moment. So now in your mind you have made the model of a cake that you like. So you are now attached. You were attached always, but now it's surfaced. It was suppressed all this time because you were watching TV. So you were being relieved of the vexation for sights through your TV. Someone says cake, now that old vexation that you had surfaces. And the one for TV suppresses momentarily. So now this vexation is so strong and your mouth even starts watering. You know, if you really think about it, right? Someone says cake, and now your body goes into it's now preparing to eat cake. You say, when can I have some? He or she says, I'll cut a slice and bring it to you in a minute. You say, okay, I'll wait here. A minute passes, no cake. 2 minutes, no cake. 5 minutes, no cake. Are you not vexing for it now? Don't you become nervous? Hey, where's that cake you said I was gonna get? Can you bring it already? You start asking. Isn't that because they reminded you of cake? What if you were just watching TV and no one said cake? Would you be asking for it now? No. Because that attachment, that vexation, was not surfaced. There was no output, there was no stimulus that came from the outside world for that vexation for cake to surface. Because until such time, you were just watching TV. You were engrossed in your TV watching experience. The attachment, the vexation for cake, or the attachment for vexation, so the attachment for cake was there, but the vexation for it was suppressed. Because the mind can only be relieved of vexation in one way at any given time. It's either a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, or touch, or a thought object that comes into the mind, okay? So only one of six can come at any given time. So no matter what one, or no matter which one of these six comes, you're relieved of vexation. So if you're relieved of vexation from one, you're not looking for a second one at that point in time. Does that make sense? You're watching TV right now, you're being relieved of vexation. You're not going to be looking for something else until that comes into as a dhamma into your mind. That's where it all starts. Until someone says cake, when the word hits your ear and now that stimulus goes through your brain into your mind, you hear the word cake, but it's not hearing the word cake that triggered this vexation for cake. In your mind, what you did was you went back into history, pulled back all those memories of cake, delicious cake, yummy cake, lovely cake, and now that vexation for cake has surfaced. All of this is happening inside the mind. This is all Abhisankara. Okay? Now you're vexing for cake, and now that vexation can only be relieved, how? By watching TV? By listening to the radio? Reading a newspaper? No. It can only be relieved by giving you a piece of cake. Because this vexation exists because of the attachment to cake, but that attachment to cake exists because of ignorance that says cake is pleasurable. So if cake is pleasurable, then that pleasure cannot be found from anything else. It has to be from cake. So this has now just been surfaced. When this is surfaced, this fire can only be, you know, it's like there are different types of fire, right? Some fire can be put out with water. Others can be put out with sand. Others with foam and carbon dioxide and so on and so forth. Depends on what kind of fire it is. What material has been set on fire. If it's oil, then you can't chuck water at it and expect the fire to go off. So likewise, depending on which vexation has surfaced, that vexation can be relieved by that particular object. But that's only because you believe that pleasure is in the outside object. That's why you're vexing in the first place. So, again, to summarize what we just described there, let me draw it out just to make it really clear. Repeat the question, please. Yes. So remember, you don't lose the desire, it's only suppressed. Because if you lost it, next day you're not going to ask for it again. Or in a week's time or a month's time, you're not going to ask for cake if it was removed, eradicated. It's only suppressed. So here's what's going on then. You're watching TV up until this point. Someone says cake. Now, remember this is running on ignorance and attachment, this platform, okay? Someone says cake, and now this mind is now vexing for cake. Okay? So when the mind is vexing for cake, now what it wants to do is give rise to a pack of five that relates to cake. That vexation cannot now be relieved any longer by watching TV. It cannot be relieved by doing anything else other than by eating cake. Because cake is pleasurable. That is the view, that distorted perception, that distorted conscience that this mind is under at this point in time. Okay? So now, at least it has to be fooled that this is cake. It doesn't have to be cake. The mind needs to know that this is cake. So you could feed this person biscuit and say, no, actually that's cake. Oh, alright, okay then. Because it's not the object that brings us pleasure. It's relief from vexation. So here's what's going on. Someone says cake at this point. Now, because the mind is attached to cake, it's like the mother that was looking for the child. The moment you lose something you like, what are you going to do? You're going to go looking for it. So the moment someone says cake, now the mind is looking for it. The process of looking is a pleasant one or an unpleasant one. You remember how many times you've lost things. And you've gone looking for them, right? Was that ever a pleasurable feeling? When you've been looking around your home, under the mattress, in the toilet, in your cupboards, right? Turning the carpets upside down, turning the house upside down, sometimes looking for things. Was that ever a pleasurable feeling? No, you could even sense your heart beating go up, right? When you lost something really, really valuable, whether it was a person or an object, it didn't matter. So that process or this activity of searching is never a fun thing to do. This is why Google was invented. So you could be relieved of that vexation quite easily. Otherwise people had to go turn books, go to the library. So vexing. Now invent Google, you can really be relieved of vexation quite easily. This is why Google now does instant search results. Your search results start to appear as you type. You don't even have to hit enter. Why? Quicker relief from vexation. Yes or no? Yes. So, cake. You hear the word cake, and now the mind's in vexation. So now what the mind is doing is expecting a set of five associated with cake or related to cake to come in from the outside world. Okay? But the problem with this is, it's only vipakas that ever come. I'm not going to go there for now because that's going to be another level of abstraction. I'm not going to touch that now, but something for you to think. No matter whether the mind is working for it or just expecting it to come, it's only going to be a vipaka. Whether you ask for it or just wait for it to come, it's only going to be a vipaka. Okay? But anyway. So the mind is now working hard to get a pack of five that is to do with cake. Right? So at this point in time, it goes into Google mode. What's the mind doing now? Searching, looking for cake. And that looking process is very vexatious. It's very vexing rather than vexatious. It's vexing. Telenoa. Right? So it's suffering now. When it's suffering, it's now doing all this abhisankara, trying to get this five about, because remember, the mind does not know cake. It only knows what? Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. It's not the tongue that's looking for cake. It's not the mouth, it's not your tummy that's looking for cake. It's the mind that's looking for cake. But mind never ate cake. All the mind ate was Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. So the only way that the mind knows of cake is Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. So now it's trying to give rise to a pack of five, this pack of Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana. It's searching for it, it's looking for it. The brain sends a packet of five. And this packet is to do with cake, and it's what the mind was looking for all this time. Right? So because it was what the mind was looking for, the moment you find what you are looking for, how much longer do you go looking for it? You lost your keys, you found your keys, how much longer did you go looking for it? You lost your child, you found your child, how many more minutes did you go looking for your child? You stopped that activity immediately, didn't you? Yes. At that point in time, when you stopped this vexing activity, did you not feel a sense of pleasure? But because this mind is running on a platform of ignorance, the mind comes to the conclusion, it's the cake that brought me pleasure. Not realizing that I was looking for it, because I found it, I no longer have to look for it. I no longer have to search for it. This process of searching, this process of seeking and looking, that is the vexing bit. That is why this abhisankara was being done. At this point in time now, as a vipaka, cake has just come in. The five to do with cake has just come in. That rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana, it could be a rupa rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, sparsha rupa. Let's say it's the rupa rupa. I can explain something. Let's take the rupa rupa, because I'll explain to you in a moment how if you start with a vexation of 100, this keeps going down in stages. I'll come to that in a moment, right? So now rupa rupa. You were looking for that five, you just found that five, and now no longer vexing. But this five passes away as well. At this point in time, again you go into vexing mode. But cake is still there. Immediately, nothing else but cake is being fed. And again, you are relieved of that vexation. And that passes away. Again, you go back, where's my cake? And again, this cake comes along. And now again, you're being relieved of vexation. Now, as you eat a bit of cake, if in a chitta, this happens a billion times, how long does it take to eat a bit of cake? Just one tiny bit? How many seconds? Usually a minute, or even more, right? If it's a billion times a second, then in a minute, this is running many trillions of times. So many trillions of times, you're asking for it, you're getting it. You're asking for it, you're getting it. You're asking for it, you're getting it. What happens if you're always asking for it and you're always getting it at the moment you ask for it? Does it go up in value, or do you lose value in it? You lose value in it. So this is what happens. All this time, cake was so delicious. Cake was so pleasurable because you were looking for it and you couldn't find it. But now you're constantly being fed with it, and because it's constantly being fed, now the value that you give it starts to reduce, starts to diminish. Because you're asking, You're getting every time you ask for it. Therefore, after a little while, you become sick of it. In other words, that same, the value that you gave it, you don't give it anymore. The value has now diminished, the value has now reduced, so therefore it's not as pleasurable as it used to be. You still experience pleasure it with every chitta, but you take the whole thing as one. Now, you don't feel the same sense of pleasure anymore. This is why, after you've been eating cake for a few minutes, now you want something else. Now you want a cup of tea, or a cheese sandwich, or something else. Now you want a pudding, something different. Because all those attachments for all these things are all suppressed. But what happens is, because you're constantly being fed with this, it's like, you know, think about this for a moment, right? You bring some flowers home, okay? Fresh flowers. Today's day one. You bring it, you put it into a beautiful vase and you put it on your table or somewhere. Every moment you see these flowers, as you walk past your living room, you're going to go, oh, beautiful flowers, aren't they? In your mind, you're not going to feel that. On day one, you will feel that. Day two, not so much. Day three, day four, time to change. Day four, it's time to change for you. But your friend comes around, or your neighbor comes around. Oh, beautiful flowers. Why? They've just seen it for the first time. This is why, a couple of years after marriage, so really, if you really, really love the person you want to get married to, what's the best thing to do? Don't marry them. Why? Then you don't get to live with them, and then you're going to value them the same way you did on the first day you started to value them. Because you can't relieve yourself from vexation every time you want to. This is why, you know, if you've traveled at the airport, you see people meet each other and how they greet each other at the airport. Right? Some people just go hand to hand, others give a hug, others give a pat on the back, others hug and they keep hugging for several minutes, and others have tears of joy that come rushing through their eyes. Sometimes it's the same relationship between them, mother-son or husband-wife. But the difference in the way that they are greeted is usually directly proportional to the time that they have been apart. So the factor that determined how pleasurable this experience was is how long they've been apart. And why is that? They were vexing, but they couldn't relieve themselves from vexation, because that you could, the object was not there to relieve yourself, to keep getting the five, this set of five constantly. That's what I say. So if you really, really, really like somebody, the best thing to do is don't marry them. Then you will continue to like them the same way you did on day one. But after you get married, you bring them home. Now, there's a beautiful saying in Sinha, like, I don't know the similar expression in English. I have to go and look up one. Say, "Hamadama dakina kukulage karamale sudui." This is what happens. Yes, man. This is supply and demand. You're demanding it, and you're being supplied continuously. Then what happens? Value goes down. But when the demand stops, sorry, when the supply stops, then demand goes back up again. What is demand here? Vexation. Yeah. So because this, we can only see through wisdom. None of us is ever going to be able to see chitta rising and passing away until or unless you become a Buddha. A supreme Buddha can see every chitta arising and passing away. He can look at his mind, he can look at your mind and go, oh, there's one chitta, there's another one, there's another one, there's another one. But by the time he said there's another one, there's a billion more has just gone by. So we don't have that capability. But through wisdom, you know, how do we know that actually arising and passing away happens in the mind? How do we know that? What's a simple test? What's this? What number is this? What's this? How do you know? How could you tell that this is now two and previously this was one? Because when you were looking at me doing this, there was a chitta that arose and that passed away. This is why when I did this, you were able to see that. A new set of five were given the opportunity to arise because that original chitta passed away. So the rate of change, you know, a good way to test the rate of change, at least, you know, to a level that you can perceive. If you look outside when it's raining, if you can see drops of water falling from the sky or hitting your window, right, you know that at least at that rate, your chittas are rising and passing away. At least at that rate. But you're not ever going to get anywhere close to it. But at least at that rate. If you can see the blades of a fan spinning, at least at that rate, your chittas are rising and passing away. Now, is that why? Because you can't see it spinning? On this occasion, it's not that your mind is not going any faster than the blades, but your eye can't pick it up. Or your brain cannot process that at that rate. That's why, not the mind. If the brain were capable of processing the speed of the blades at that frequency, your mind is capable of many million times that. So it's not the mind lacking in capability, it's the brain this time round lacking capability. Okay? Now let me go to what I was trying to explain here. Someone says, would you like cake? Okay, let's imagine you've never seen cake. You don't know what cake is. Okay? But something we have all experienced is pleasure in our lives, right? Is there anyone here who hasn't experienced pleasure? No, we've all experienced pleasure. So we are not newcomers to pleasure. Right? We've all experienced pleasure. Throughout samsara, that's what kept us going through transmigration is pleasure, right? That's what we always attached ourselves to. So pleasure is not something new to us. So if pleasure is not something that's new to us, then when someone instills this drushti, this view in a mind, what they need to plant in our mind is not that the world is pleasurable. Because we already know that, don't we? We already know that the world is pleasurable. At least, you know, yes, that is a distorted view. But we do know, even if erroneously, we do know that even if that view is flawed, we do know that the world is pleasurable, right? So the only thing then that a salesman, I'll call it a salesman, Asat Purusha, that's what a salesman is, right? The only thing what a salesman has to do, when they come across someone who accepts that the world is pleasurable, is to say that this also is pleasurable. So if I'm trying to sell you this pen, and you have a belief that pens are pleasurable in general, I don't need to sell you the concept that pens are pleasurable, because that you have accepted from the beginning of samsara. All I have to do is tell you, this is also a pen, and this is also pleasurable. Because you're prepared and you're willingly accepting that outside objects are pleasurable. Objects in the outside world are pleasurable, right? So the same applies for cake. You don't know what cake is, you've never seen cake, but you accept and you agree that the world is pleasurable. A piece of cake is also part of the world, is it not? If it's something you take through your eyes, nose, ears, tongue and mouth and body, then it has to be something that comes from the outside world. So when you accept that the world is pleasurable, and I come and tell you, cake, there's something called cake, and it's beautiful, I mean, it looks gorgeous, and it's yummy, it's so tasty. Now, we've all experienced gorgeous before, we've all experienced tasty before, we've all experienced yummy before. All we need to now take in is, oh, there's another thing that's also gorgeous. There's another thing that's also yummy. There's another thing that's also delicious. Let me go find it. Because if there's something that's delicious, where does it have to be? Out there or with me? It's got to be with me. If something's yummy, where has it got to be? Out there or with me? If someone's beautiful, where do they have to be? Out there or with me? With me. That's why you put the ring on it. Because if something's good looking, someone's good looking, then they can't be out there, they've got to be with me. So I'm telling you, cake is also yummy. Now what you do is you go looking for it. You've just kick-started your Google search engines. You just kicked off your search engine. I've just said, cake is yummy. Now you go, you ask me, where can I find it? Remember man's best in greatest inventions? Do you remember? What, why, when, who, which, where? Because these questions help you relieve yourself of vexation. So I tell you, cake is yummy, you ask me, where can I find it? So you can relieve yourself from vexation. Exactly, a bakery. So what you do now is you go looking for a bakery, you walk into the bakery and now you can see items of confectionery laid out on these, in these cupboards or whatever, right? Cabinets. Now you don't know what cake is because you've never seen what cake is. This is new to you. All you know is there is something called cake and cake is pleasurable. Now you ask the shopkeeper, can I have some cake please? And he says, oh yes, sure sir. Which one would you like? So he points his arm at cake. You go, oh, so this is cake. The moment you see what cake looks like, are you not relieved of vexation? Yes. But you know, because your friend said so, that cake is something you eat. If there's something that you eat, then surely it has to have a sight. It has to have smell. Right? It has to have taste. And it has to have touch. Or the sensation, or you should be able to feel it. Otherwise, how can you eat it? All these four things you have to be able to receive from cake. Yes or no? Yes. So the shopkeeper says, that's cake. Now, you are vexing four times over, but one you have just been relieved of. You've just been given sight. You were at 100%. Now you're down to 75%. Because sight of cake has just been transferred to you. That five you have just been gifted with, so therefore you have just been relieved of that. But another 75 remain. Or at least, let's go, 75. 75 remains, right? Now you ask the shopkeeper, can I have some please? She says, yeah, sure. Let me get you some. So he puts a piece on this on a plate and hands it over to you. Now you're able to touch it. So you're vexing now. What does it feel like? What does it feel like? So as the moment you feel the piece of cake, now you're relieved of another vexation. That drops down to another 25%, down to 50. Next you want to know, well, there are two more senses that you can satisfy by cake. Or so you think. Or so you think. Because what are you thinking right now? Pleasure is in the cake. You don't realize that this is your search engine that is now stopping. Your search engine was running at 100%. Now it's dropped down to 75%. And as soon as you were able to touch it, it dropped down to 50%. Now it's running at 50% capacity. Then you take that bit of cake and now you're bringing it towards your mouth. But before it touches your lips, you can do what to it? Smell it. The moment you smell it, now again you're relieved of the vexation that is associated with smell. Down to 25. One more remain. What if at this point in time someone comes and pulls it away from you? Well, this vexation has been relieved. This has been relieved. This has been relieved. But there's one more that remains. What happens though is this, the remaining 25 becomes the 100. It's like air. Right? When you fill a container with air, no matter how much air you put in, it takes up all of the volume of that room or that container or whatever. This is the nature of air. You put in a little bit more, it's going to take up all of it. You take away some and just leave a little bit, it's still taking up all of the volume of that room. That's how this works. So yes, it does, you know, this is just a model I was trying to explain, 75, 50, but as it drops down to 75, the remaining 75 fills up the 100. The remaining 50 fills up the 100. The remaining 25 fills up the 100, and finally that last 25 you're waiting to take through your tongue, that is now taking up 100. That is why when they pull it out of your hand, otherwise you should not get that angry. I mean, yes, I've been relieved of sight and sound and or sight and smell and touch, you know. I'm only 25% there. I shouldn't be feeling this angry. But what happens? That 25 has filled up the entire 100. So now if they pull that out of your hand, you're going to go ape mad. But if you're now able to put that on your tongue, now you have been relieved all the way down to zero. But for how long? I have me cake. Where's my cake? The cake's on your tongue. Oh. Oh, thank God, my cake is back. Where's my cake? Do you see how much you're suffering? With every chitta that arises and passes away. For as long as it's running on this platform of attachment, you are going through tremendous suffering. This is torture. Yes or no? This is extreme torture, like no torture you've ever seen before. You could make a horror movie out of this. Yes or no? This is the best plot there is for a horror movie. I can't think of a better horror movie than this. Why? Suffering every, not millisecond, not femtosecond, not attosecond, not microseconds. We are talking about billions of a second. Suffering. So much pain. Because there's attachment all the way through. So it's not that, you know, someone says, I have lots of money, so I don't have to suffer. Is that true? Having lots of money, can you stop this from happening? No. So does it matter how much money you have? Does it matter how much property you have? How much gold you have? How many women you have? No, because no matter what you have, whatever it is that you're experiencing, if you're attached to it, whatever arises has to pass away. At the moment of passing away, you're going to ask, where's Wally? Where's he gone? And now you have to do that abhisankara to bring it back. And then no matter how hard you try, it's still going to do what? It's still going to pass away again. You can't stop this from happening. Do you not see how helpless you are? If you try to stop this, do you see how helpless you are? And if you think earning lots of money means I can get lots of things that's going to bring me lots of sets of five, do you see how foolish you are? Do you see how ignorant you are? There's only one cause for suffering. Attachment. Can you imagine how much wisdom the Buddha must have had to come up with this? Remember, he didn't invent this. He discovered this is what happens in our minds. He discovered it. You know, you don't have to go down to this level, but when you go down to this level of detail, you realize, good heavens, it's not like I'm happy today and I'm going to be sad tomorrow. It's not like mother's been diagnosed with cancer, so she's going to be dying tomorrow. Today she's here with me, so I can be happy. Seriously? Your mother's dying of cancer every billions of a second. Your mother's dying. Every billions of a second, your husband's dying. Every billions of a second, your child is dying. Every billions of a second, who else is dying? You are dying. Every billions of a second, you're being born, you die. Birth, death, birth and death. This is the reincarnation you need to understand. Not whether there's life after birth, life after death. That's not the suffering we need to understand. This is the reincarnation you need to understand. How with every moment, whatever's born, dies. How are we doing for time? Good heavens. An arahant and a non-arahant, I think is who you mean, madam. Yeah. So yes, there is. This is the nature of a non-arahant. What's the only thing I need to do to make this the nature of an arahant? That's an arahant. What was that line I just erased? Ignorance and attachment. Now, does it matter whether you get the five or no five? Or whether the five comes and stays there forever? Or passes away and never arises? No, because you're not attached to it. You don't care. But for as long as you care, for as long as you're attached, this is why I say, you know, love thy neighbor. If you love thy neighbor, then what's going to happen to you when something happens to your neighbor? There's going to be suffering. It's a recipe for disaster. From a Nibbana point of view. From a general living in the world point of view, good. This is why I say, I mean, there's nothing wrong with love thy neighbor for as long as you just want to go continue living in this world and you're okay with this. If you're okay with this, of course, love thy neighbor. If you're not okay with this, then stop loving thy neighbor. So yeah. What other things, man? Oh yes, that was a question you asked. So I have to answer your first question before we conclude. There are five causes which are responsible for the arising of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana. So avidya samudaya, rupa samudaya, tanha samudaya, rupa samudaya, ahara samudaya, rupa samudaya, karma samudaya, rupa samudaya, nibbati lakkhana, rupa samudaya. That's another level of detail. What we need to get from that is that for the five to do, so when we talk about a five, this is what? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, right? This is the five we're talking about. So each of these is dependent on other factors. For example, this rupa is dependent on avidya, tanha, kamma, ahara, nibbati lakkhana. Yes. So 25 for arising, and the passing away or the cessation of these 25 leads to the cessation of them, or rather the passing away of them, and therefore 25 plus 25, that's how you get your 50. We can talk about the detail behind this, but what we need to get from recognizing that there are factors, these are the factors that determine the arising of rupa, is that where is my liking here? Where is my desire? My wanting, my intention, where is that here? Yeah.
Avidya, tanha, kamma. That's 3 out of 5. You cannot do anything about ahara, and there's nothing you can do about nibbati lakkhana.
Besides, this avidya, it could be the avidya of karma that you did maybe a million births ago. Now, you know, for instance, someone hits you. It's painful. Isn't that another five that just arose? That's a five, and that five is going to pass away as well. Do you like that five? No. But is that not the result of avidya, tanha, kamma, ahara, nibbati lakkhana? Yes. But that was avidya, tanha and kamma, perhaps from a deed, an unmeritorious deed that you did many births ago. Thing is, we are helpless in the face of the fact that what gives rise to rupa are these things. And we don't really have a say here. So, you know, even if the Buddha, still it's five arising, five passing away. But a Buddha does not have avidya or tanha or karma. A Buddha doesn't have any of them. But these are now past avidya. Avidya that was in the past. Tanha that was in the past. Karma that was done in the past. Now they're bringing vipaka. So this rupa really is the vipaka of these things. This was the karma. This is now the vipaka. The ahara is whatever is present present factors in the environment at that point in time. And Nibbati Lakkhana is nothing other than the Paricchasamuppada process. Either evamitasa kevalasa dukkakanda samudaya hoti, or evamitasa kevalasa dhammanang samudaya hoti, one or the other. I'm not going to go into that detail today because we don't have the time and we've talked about quite a bit already, so you need time to distill this and digest it. So I want to conclude by answering this the other question: how do we do merit without having to go through the rebirth process? The reason we do merits is also because we are vexing. To relieve ourselves of vexation, there are one of three things you can do. This is mental vexation I'm talking about. There are one of three things you can do. This is not to redeem, but to relieve. To redeem vexation, as in to stop vexation, there's only one thing you can do. That is to eradicate attachment. That is kusala. But to relieve yourself of vexation, there are three things you can do. One is punya karma, apunya karma, and aninjabi karma. Aninja karma are the karmas that you do that bring you rebirth in the rupavachara brahma worlds. I'm not going to talk about them for today. Sorry, arupavachara brahma worlds. Okay, I'm not going to talk about them today. The other two, punya abhisankara and apunya abhisankara, these are both sankara or abhisankara rather, they are karmas. An arahant does not do karma. The reason an arahant does not do karma is because whenever we do karma, remember, we are trying to change the outside world. That's what a karma is. So for example, you see a poor man, he's hungry. When we see a poor man who's hungry, in our mind, we don't like to see a poor man. We don't like to see a hungry person. So we have a preference. An arahant might also see a beggar, a hungry person, and an arahant will, perhaps if he has a meal, he might give that meal to that person, but not to relieve himself of vexation, because there's no vexation, there's no preference for the arahant. There is right and wrong, not good and bad. There's a difference. There's what's right, there's what's wrong. But what's right and wrong is not always what's good and bad. Good and bad is very subjective, but right and wrong, that's objective. If you take the law book, you'll find right and wrong, not good and bad. Good and bad is dasa punya kriya and dasa akusala kriya. Dasa punya kriya is good, dasa akusala is bad. But right and wrong, that is very objective. So, an arahant is not attached to any state, whether internal or external. There's no state that the arahant is attached to. He doesn't really, you've got to take this carefully. An arahant doesn't really care that a man is hungry. Not in the sense that you and I do. But he realizes there's a hungry man. I'm able to do something about it, therefore I'm going to do it. But let's say he walks to this man to offer him this meal. Really simple example, right? You see a poor man on the street. He's hungry. He says, please can I have some food? You have a packet of rice that you've wrapped up to have for lunch. You take this packet to this man and he says, what do you have there, madam? And you say, rice and curry. Oh, I don't really like rice and curry. Don't you have fried rice or something? Can I have money instead, please? Does that not upset you, even a tiny bit? He says, can I have short eats instead? I don't like rice and curry. Can I have a hot cup of tea with that as well, please? Does that not upset you even a tiny bit? Because you have a preference. Your preference is, you're hungry, I want to help you, and I'm going to help you the way I want to help you. Not the way I can help you, I'm going to help you the way I want to help you. So you go and help that person, because in doing so, you're not only relieving that person of their vexation, you're also relieving yourself of your vexation. Because you're vexing. Because you're attached to a particular state. You have a preference. Whereas an arahant does not have a preference. He or she sees the vexation that another person is in, either mentally or physically. So when an arahant preaches the Dhamma, he does not acquire any merit. I'm not an arahant. So when I preach the Dhamma to you, I am relieving myself of vexation myself. I'd be lying to say no, that is not the case. I'd be lying to say that. Because this is why when I preach to you, if you're engaged in other activities and not paying attention, then sometimes that disrupts the flow. And this is why I say, I can't continue until you have finished doing something or something like that. Not only because it's not right or wrong, but in my mind I'm vexing. Because I have ignorance and attachment. But the day I become an arahant, I might point it out because it's the wrong thing. I might point it out because you have to be doing the right thing, but not right or wrong for me, because it's the right or wrong thing for you. And in that, on that occasion, I am not vexing. So what if you don't do what I ask you to do? So what? I don't care. Because it's not the right or wrong thing for me, it's the right or wrong thing for you. Therefore, don't do it. So, how do we do medicine without having to go through the rebirth process? By becoming an arahant. The day you become an arahant, you can still do merit. I mean, the Buddha, the best arahant there ever was, right? Did he not preach the Dhamma? Isn't the gift of Dhamma the gift that excels all gifts? So, when it comes to charity, is there better charity than the charity of Dhamma? Is there better giving than the giving of the best gift there is to give? It's the gift of Dhamma. So he spent his entire life giving us the gift of Dhamma. But did he earn a tiny bit of merit, even a tiny bit of merit by doing that? No. Because for merit to be earned, you have to be vexing. You have to be in vexation. No vexation, you are not earning any merit. Because that's not a karma that you are doing. Karmas are done to relieve oneself of vexation. But the Buddha will still do good deeds. But no merit will be acquired as a result of that. So, yes, madam. Yes. So you will earn. Yes. Yeah. There are only 8 types of kusala. That is the Arya Ashtanga Marga. That is the only kusala. But remember, even the Arya Ashtanga Marga or the Noble Eightfold Path, even when one is practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, that is still being, you know, it's still the mind that's going through that practice, and that mind is still running on a platform of what? Ignorance and attachment. So even someone who's trying to attain Nibbana is still earning merit. And that's okay. Remember, you don't have to consume all your merit before you enter Paranibbana or become an arahant. Just because that was Nigantanatha Putta, whose philosophy was, if you've done karmas, then you're not going to stop rebirth until you have exhausted all the karmas you have done. Why do you think he walked naked? Why do you think he and his clan, his followers, what their belief was, all the bad karmas that we've done in the past, we can only attain nirvana, their notion of nirvana, by suffering for all the karma that we've done in the past. So therefore, they brought pain on themselves. So that was self-mortification. So if I bring pain onto myself, then I am bringing on myself vipaka for the karmas that I've done in the past. Yes, that is what's happening. But when are you going to exhaust all the karmas that you've done in the past? You've come an infinitely long journey in samsara. You think 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even a lifetime of going through nothing but intense suffering is going to exhaust all the karmas you've done in the past? No. And the thing is this. Even when you bring vipaka to yourself, isn't that also another karma? Starving. Let's say you want to starve yourself. Right? So now you are suffering for the vipaka of a bad karma in the past. Because starving is a physical pain, right? physical pain can never be the result of a good karma. So if you starve yourself, then that is the vipaka of a bad karma you've done in the past. Full stop, no question about that. But what you're doing now is you're inflicting this on yourself. Because that thought process is based in ignorance and attachment. So in doing that, you're not only suffering for vipaka of your bad karmas, but you're also doing a karma again. Not necessarily a bad karma, because you're not inflicting damage or pain or hardship on anybody else. Because for it to be a bad karma, it has to be something you do to somebody else. Okay? It has to be something you do to somebody else. And because you're bringing, because you're starving yourself, you're not acquiring demerit as a result of that. There's no bad karma as a result of that. But because of this karma, you'll be born again. So you can't stop samsara by trying to exhaust all the karmas that you've done in the past. That's just it's not possible. It's not feasible. That is flawed, that logic. So the only way you can stop karma is by eradicating attachment. Because once you eradicate attachment, after that, it's only activities that you do. This is just kriya, not karma. It's just an activity. Whether it's going for alms, whether it's giving something that you have to somebody else, it might be excess food or whatever it might be. It could be offering flowers. An arahant might bring a flower and offer it at the Buddha's feet and worship the Buddha. But that's not going to earn him any karma. But you and I, if we do that, that's going to earn us punya karma. Good karmas. There's nothing wrong with that. But for that punya karma to bear fruit, we have to be born somewhere else, or in our present birth it can come back to us as good vipaka. Then there's nothing wrong with good vipaka. So what we can do is, when you offer alms, offer flowers, give something to somebody, maybe a beggar or whatever the case might be, whenever you do a good karma, you can make a determination. You can focus that karma, the results of that karma, to help you fulfill the path to Nibbana. That resolve you can make in your mind. So for example, you offer a dana to Swami Nuances at the temple or wherever, and alongside your normal ambition, which is, or rather your goal of transferring merits to your parents, alongside that, what you can do is, may these merits help me to attain Nibbana. Because now you're not asking, it's like going and asking for a loan really. You can ask for a loan and say, what's a loan for? To build a house, to buy a car, to go on holiday, to buy a phone, or to pay off another loan. At least when you pay off another loan, now you're one loan less. So you're taking this loan to relieve yourself, or rather to address a problem that you already have. Because taking the loan is bringing another problem. But at least you're using that to address another problem that you already have. So if you can focus your merit, and all you have to do is make that resolve in your mind, I want this, I'm doing this merit to help me stop my rebirth process, to attain Nibbana. And when you do so, the merit that you acquire is many, many, many times more. Because you are one who realizes that this samsara is not one that's worth hanging around in. Because that view is sammāditti. Now your merit is based in right view. Therefore the potential, the potency of that merit is much greater than merit that you might do to, you know, one could say, offer flowers, may I be beautiful in my next birth. That chances are that will happen. But for that you have to be born again. But when you do merit and make a wish, It's more a determination than making a wish. It's a thought process, yes. It's focusing it for that purpose. When you do a merit and focus the merit of this, or the vipaka of this, on your Nibbana, then what happens is, let's say you've offered a meal to somebody. If you, for example, come and listen to a bana, a sermon, or do some meditation, maybe whenever you do a meditation, you start to feel hungry. Now you can't focus on your meditation object. But as a result of that karma that you've done, because you focused it on your Nibbana process, now when you sit down for meditation, you no longer feel hungry, because that is now the vipaka of the good karma that you did. So it's coming to help you on your path to Nibbana. So do as much merit as you can. Ma bhikkave punyanam bhaitta. Sukasa sesang ativadanam punyanti. The Buddha says, Sumana, this is in the Sumana discourse. You can read it in the Tripitaka. Sumana, do not fear merit. Do as much merit as you possibly can. This is the Buddha, in his own words. Do as much merit as you can. Merit helps all beings, humans, devas, brahmas, all beings, to live a comfortable life, and also for one who wants to go forth and attain Nibbana. It helps them to get to find the suitable environment to help them do that much easily than one who has no merit. So don't fear merit, do as much merit as you can, but don't stop at merit. Because that's being, the kusala is contemplating on this, practicing this, applying this into your life. Does that answer the question? 7 o'clock. Okay. I know you've got a long way to go, so we'll conclude the sermon there. Is that okay? Was that helpful? So you were lucky that you came along today. So I figured that today's listeners will have to be regular listeners and those who are really dedicated to this course of Nibbana. Because otherwise, when you have a long weekend, chances are you're probably going to find something else to do. I repeat, just because you're not here, because people will be listening to this, just because you're not here doesn't mean you're not dedicated, but the fact that you are here confirms that. At least that's how I like to think. Hopefully I'm right. Okay. So then, before we conclude, could someone get me the Arya Maitreya leaflet, please? I think last week we chanted it in Sinhala. Yes. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of birth, freed from the fire of decay, freed from the fire of illness, freed from the fire of death, freed from the fire of sorrow, freed from the fire of lamentation, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of suffering, freed from the fire of discontentment, freed from the fire of exhaustion, freed from the fire of disappointment, freed from the fire of clinging on to the five aggregates, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the suffering of samsara, freed from the disease of samsara, freed from the fear of samsara, freed from the fire of samsara, freed from the flames of samsara, freed from the burning of samsara, freed from the sorrow of samsara, freed from the lust of samsara, freed from the clutches of samsara, healed with the ultimate bliss of nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of nibbana, healed with the ultimate bliss of nibbana. The karma worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the karma worlds. The rupa worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the rupa worlds. The arupa worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from the arupa worlds. All worlds are in despair. May I and all beings be freed from all the worlds. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Letting go is the only salvation. May I and all beings let go. Detachment is the only salvation. May I and all beings be detached. Being freed is the only salvation. May I and all beings be freed. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. Nibbana is the only salvation. May I and all beings attain Nibbana. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the bondage of lust, freed from the bondage of aversion, freed from the bondage of delusion, freed from the bondage of Mara, healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana, 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 healed with the eternal bliss of Nibbana.
Don't think of this as being a lecture. I don't like to do lectures. This was another attempt to try to get this doctrine to you in a way that I thought might help. So what you now need to do is not take out a notebook and start drawing pictures and diagrams and start taking notes, and it's okay if you do it, but I'm saying you don't feel that you have to start doing it now. Because then this becomes theory. This becomes a class. This becomes a tuition class. That's not what we are trying to do here. This is not your Buddhism tuition class, okay? I don't have time to give tuition to people. This is how I see my mind working. This is how I see my mind vexing with every moment. So what I would like you to do, what I would encourage you to try and do, is if you realize that this is the nature of the suffering that we go through every single moment that we are alive. Isn't this the nature of the karma worlds, the rupa worlds, the arupa worlds? No matter where you go, in this infinite universe, wherever there's a being, if there's a mind,
then there are chittas that arise and pass away at the same rate that it does for you and everybody else. For as long as there's attachment with every chitta, the end of which is suffering. That's it, nothing else. With every moment arise and pass away, with every chitta, life and death, life and death, life and death. That is the reincarnation that the Buddha came into this world to teach. This reincarnation you can see through wisdom. If you really understand this, then is there life after this birth? It really becomes immaterial. But if you understand this, then this will give you the answer to that question also. Because if the last chitta that you have in this birth is one that ended in vexation, and the five passed away, but did attachment and ignorance pass away with that? No, ignorance and attachment is still there. All the mind is going to do is do abhisankara to be born again. And your vipaka or your previous karma is going to determine where it's going to be. But hey, let's not go there. That can be quite touchy-feely for people. But this is what you need to understand. Every chitta is vexatious. Every chitta is vexatious. But not vexing. Vexatious. It's the adjective, not the noun. Vexatious, all you need to do to vex is what? Attach. No attachment? Then who cares? Only an arahant can ever say that. Who cares? Okay. So before we conclude then, let us transfer the merits that we have all acquired today to all those who deserve the merits. First and foremost, let us once again remind ourselves that it is because of the Supreme Buddha that we have the gift of Dhamma today. It is because he sacrificed himself infinite number of times in this infinite long journey in samsara, expecting nothing in return, and for the sole purpose of liberating all sentient beings, including you and I. It is thanks to his dedication, his commitment, his sacrifice of himself that we have the Dhamma today, to pacify ourselves, to find inner peace within ourselves. Let's also take a moment to transfer merits to the Bhikkhu Bhikkhunis Upasaka Upasikas who, since the time of the Buddha, memorized the Dhamma and then had it written down in books and transcripts and so on and so forth, manuscripts, and passed it down to us over many generations, and it's thanks to them that today we have the Tripitaka, which we can study, we can analyze, we can understand, and we can take the Dhamma from which we can come to a comprehension and attain the Margapala. May the merits that we have all acquired today be transferred to them. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains, be born in the blissful plains, and may through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to all the members of the Mahasangha, including the chief prelates, the Mahanayakas and the Anunayakas of all the chapters, of all the Nikayas, wherever in the world they may be, all members of the Mahasangha, may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. And particularly let us take a moment to transfer merits to the monks and nuns in your local temples and your local nunneries, reminding yourselves that although you may come along to this monastery, listen to sermons, make offerings to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, it is those monks and nuns in your local temples, your local nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. It is they who have the dhammapasa into which you send your children. It is they who always stand by your side and guiding you and helping you in times of trouble and helping your children become good citizens of tomorrow. So, let us not forget that. Let us be grateful for the immense service that they render to all of you. So may through the power of these merits that we have all acquired today, they be able to abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons and the dead that we invited at the start of this sermon, as well as your parents in this birth as well as in your previous births, teachers in this birth as well as in your previous births, as well as all your ancestors who may have predeceased you, uncles, aunts, nephews, grandparents, brothers, sisters, in any way, shape or form, if anyone has ever come into your life throughout this infinite long journey in samsara and helped you, assisted you, supported you in any way, shape or form, May they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. If any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains. May through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer merits to all the monks who are resident at this monastery, including a Guru Swami Nwansei, as well as all the other resident monks and anagarikas who have taken a lot of trouble to organize this event today and prepare the stage on which the Dharma, the sermon is being delivered. So this is an offering that they have made to the Dharma Ratna, as well as everyone and each and everyone among you who have taken great trouble to organize this event and make this venue available and make this event possible, perhaps by inviting others to come along today, perhaps by providing them with transport, or perhaps by offering them a meal in order to quench their thirst, sate their hunger, so that they could listen to this sermon in comfort. Whatever way, shape or form that you might have contributed to this meritorious deed, may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. May through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to everyone who have helped you and relieved you so that you could be here today. It could be your employees, your employers from your workplaces who are today looking after your responsibilities, your duties. They are fulfilling them so that you are free to be here today. Or it could be members of your family who are looking after your duties and responsibilities towards the family and your neighbors and so on and so forth. It is because of them you are today relieved so that you can be here today and listen to this Dhamma and attain Nibbana. So may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. As well as just let us take a moment to transfer merits to members of the armed forces who fought a long 30-year-old long war in Sri Lanka. It is thanks to them that today we can live in peace and harmony with each other. They sacrificed their lives to protecting and preserving our motherland. May they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today, as well as members of the police force. Also men and women who might have lost their lives in the Cold War that lasted in Sri Lanka. They may be friend or foe, but if there's anyone among them who are looking for merits, may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. As well as that, let's take a moment to transfer merits to all those men and women who might have lost their lives in natural calamities such as the tsunamis that struck Sri Lanka a long time ago. As well as wherever in the world you may be, if there are friends, family, as well as those who may not be friends, family or acquaintances. Not forgetting that in this infinite long journey in samsara, there's not been a man or a woman who has never been a mother or a father to you. So no matter what their relationship may be to you in this birth, in this infinite long journey in samsara, everyone's been a mother, everyone's been a father, and they have shed blood, tears and sweat on your behalf. So may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. If any of them have today been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains. May through the power of these merits they abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to those men and women who have dedicated themselves to protecting this country, leading this country, and developing this country. It is thanks to them that today you and I have the freedom of time and space to be here today and practice the path in peace and harmony. If not for them today, you and I will have to be leading this country, developing this country, protecting this country day and night. So may they all be able to rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. If any of them in the past have been born in the woeful plains, may through the power of these merits they be able to redeem themselves from those woeful plains and be born in the blissful plains, may through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may through the power of the merits that we have all acquired today over many hours of preaching the Dhamma, listening to the Dhamma, discussing the Dhamma and contemplating on the Dhamma, as well as making offerings by offering flowers and incense and oil lamps to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, may through all the merits that we have all acquired today in making this event possible in any way, shape or form that you might have contributed by inviting people to be here, perhaps by providing them with transport, or perhaps by just by offering someone a glass of water, or perhaps by ushering someone to a seat, in whichever way or shape or form you might have contributed, or perhaps by making the technology that is being used here available, whether you're here in person or joining us from around the world, wherever you may be, in whatever way, shape or form you might have contributed, if not through physical labor, perhaps by a well-wish that you might have extended from wherever you might have been, may through the power of all these merits that we have all acquired today, may we be able to witness in this very birth itself the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahatun Mahanses on this blessed land in the very near future. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may you and I and every one of us who have contributed to making this event possible, joined us and have been present here either in person as a human or as a non-human, either in person by being seated here or by joining us through the internet or wherever and whichever form you could, may all of us who have taken part in this meritorious deed, may all of us who have listened to the Dhamma, who have used the Dhamma to remove the cankers, the defilements that are in our minds, to attain the bliss of Nibbana, may all these merits help us all to become one of those Arahatun Mahanses, one of those Arahat Mehanin Mahanses, and be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself, in this very human birth itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midetva, dvesha ginnen midetva, moha ginnen midetva, nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo. Nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva. Nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva.
Tunurvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen silu loka silu sattayoma nibbana parama sukhayen sukhita taravetva. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of desire. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fires of aversion. May I and all beings in all worlds be freed from the fire of delusion. May I and all beings in all worlds attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. May the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.